Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to week two of the season. Episode 2 of The Ruck, your podcast from the Times, the Sunday Times. We're back in the studio, which is a blessed relief, or at least I am, Alex Lowe. I'm joined by Owen Slott, Chief Rugby Correspondent of the Times.
Hello, mate.
Still.
Easy. You're going to usurp me soon, I can tell.
Alan Dimmock, Features Editor from Rugby World. And down the line this week is Stephen Jones, because have you run out of petrol?
I didn't run out of petrol. I had to ferry round people who had run out of petrol.
And now
I've got loads of petrol.
Oh, you've still got loads of petrol?
Available to anyone.
Is it? How much have you got?
I got half a tank.
And do you have a siphon where we can all come and queue up outside your house?
I've got half a tank, but no one else in the whole of Berkshire has got any.
How are we all? How was your rugby weekend?
Wonderful for me. I saw a game in which I saw two players I'd never seen before play gloriously at Wasps. Mr. Crossdale at fullback was sensational, and a really good game. Yesterday, the team I coach, Maidenhead Iron Maidens, had their first ever contact rugby match where we won a great game against High Wycombe. So I had an excellent weekend, thank you.
I think the Iron Maidens is my favourite rugby team name. I think it's brilliant. Slossy, where did you go?
I went yesterday, my first trip to the new Brentford Stadium to see London Irish. And I was watching it thinking this is the sort of game that Jonesy would be really complaining about. Because like the first 60 minutes, there were loads of tries at both ends. And it was like some sort of meaningless entertainment. But the last 20 minutes, there was a crescendo to a sort of a brilliant finish. The game finished on 31-all. Paddy Jackson had a 56-metre penalty to try and win it with the last kick of the game. You know, drama, edge of your seat. So it was brilliant. I think that's a great stadium. And there were 6,000+ crowd there yesterday. I really just hope by the end of the season there's 10,000, 15,000, because it's going to be great, that place.
I know why Slotty thinks it's great, because I was at that game as well yesterday, and he cycled up because it's so close to his house. That's why he thinks it's fantastic. He let the chauffeur,
well spotted, Al.
He let the chauffeur have the afternoon off, and he cycled in himself.
I did actually lock my bike up like 1 metre from the front door. The bike rack 1 metre from the front door. It's brilliant. So yeah, Al's got me there completely.
I do agree though. I was a bit worried. It was my first time at the Brentford Community Stadium. They need to come up with a better name than that as well.
Yeah.
It just doesn't roll off the tongue. But we can get there.
The Coventry Building Society Stadium's the other one. I think they need to.
Yeah.
Oh well. What's the name of Welford Road? There's something.
Mattioli Woods, Welford Road.
Yeah.
I was saying yesterday, Cinch at the Franklin's Gardens sounds like a resident band, doesn't it?
Yeah.
They've done the on the screen next door. The American football's on, and Kansas City Chiefs have. They couldn't bring themselves to rename the stadium, so the field has a sponsor, a bit like at Franklin's Gardens. They basically sponsor the field, but keep the stadium name the same.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah, so it's like the Cinch Field at Franklin's Gardens, isn't it? Something like that.
The Coventry Building Society, incidentally, is a great name because their public relations people came round the media benches giving us cakes. So I think it's a brilliant name. I'm prepared to say it in full every time I go there.
Well, Steve, we've carved out a special section to discuss the North London Derby, but we'll do that after. We're joined by Christoph Ridley, one of the leading referees from the RFU, who's going to just talk us through the new laws, how he sees them from being the man in the middle, and just the picture of the game from a referee's perspective. So, Christoph, thank you for joining us. We thought a couple of rounds into the Premiership, it would be a great chance to to just refresh people on the new laws, to talk to the man in the middle about how they're sort of going, how the teams are reacting to them, and how the referees are reacting to them. What's your experience been so far?
So the first thing I've noticed really is that actually we haven't seen that many. So last week, I believe we only had 2 50-22s and one goal line dropout. And then obviously we have the changes around the latcher also, which we'll see in some games and others. But I'm surprised how little we've seen of it. So even going into my third game this weekend, I've only seen it myself twice. So we're still learning from our end and still waiting to see what the game's going to look like or whether or not they are going to make a difference. But in answer to your question, we just haven't seen them as much as we probably thought, we all probably thought we would.
Christopher, I agree that I've seen one 50-22, which I think was a by mistake. It was a kick ahead by Lewis Leiner when in the Newcastle game. Two things. One, it's clear that kicking a 50-22 is quite a skill, a hard skill. But two, even if we haven't seen them, it doesn't really matter that much, because the point of them was to try and get defences to sit back a bit more to defend that. So do you think that you've seen a different type of game just because that law's been made?
Well, what I do know is that the weekend of games we just had were, on the whole, fantastic games. A lot of them were close. Teams were coming back. There were lots of line break tries. You only have to look at the last 2 weeks try montages put out by Prem Rugby to see how good tries are being scored. And I think one of those reasons is for exactly the point you just made, which is players might be dropping out of the defensive line to cover those 50-22 threats. And as a result, there's more gaps for players to run into. So if we think about why these new laws came into play, it's about the game constantly evolving to become a better product, more enjoyable to play and watch.
Those of us who were on the pod and writing in the paper pre-season were speculating that ending the pre-latch would impact Exeter more than anyone because of the way that they play and that controlling style. They're 0-2. You were refereeing their game at the weekend. Have you noticed, or were you kind of, did you have your eyes on Exeter in particular and how they would adapt to that particular law change that no longer are you allowed to form sort of pods of three before you receive the ball?
Look, we every single team in the Premiership latches. We haven't considered how it's going to affect one team more than another, but we knew it would definitely change the way some teams play, especially teams that like to use that as one of their sort of dominant strategies. Have I noticed it? I don't think we've had enough games yet to get a fair sample. We haven't got all our players back from the lines yet. So, of course, we're going to see games with outcomes slightly different to what they might be in 3-4 weeks from now. I just don't know. So whether or not there's a clear link between teams, how teams are performing now and the law changes, or whether their teams are overperforming or underperforming depending on what players they have available, I'm just not sure. It's probably a conversation we can have in 3-4 weeks' time when we've seen these new laws play out a little bit more, and then we'll know whether teams are being impacted directly by the changes.
So you're going to come back regularly then, are you, every 3 or 4 weeks?
Oh, I'd love to do that.
Christoph, how have you found adapting to these law adaptations yourself? And has it changed the review process at all? How are the referees talking about it amongst themselves?
So just to go back a tiny bit from that, I think the fact that as a game we're constantly trying to evolve by bringing in changes, trialing things, whether it's here or in the Southern Hemisphere, I think that's a good thing. I think we need to do that. We can't just be a sport that stands still and accepts that maybe the game is really good now, so let's just keep it as it is. I think we should constantly look to evolve to create a better game to play and watch. So that's my first point on that. In terms of it being difficult, of course it is, because as a referee, you don't get to go training and play a training game with other referees. So really our training happens match day to match day. Of course we can watch and review and go train in the gym and go for a run, but actually seeing live Premiership rugby speed, and in terms of practicing, we don't really get an opportunity until we're there in the moment. And so the new laws come into place, and like the players who may have practiced them in training, we haven't done that. So although we've got an idea in our head what it may have looked like, when I turned up to my Premiership game last week, I hadn't refereed the new laws yet. And then I had my Premiership game this week, and for the first time, I refereed two goal line dropouts. So that's the challenge we have.
You would know the law book inside out. Something that Steve Hansen has said repeatedly is that there are too many laws, and we're now trialling some new ones. Does rugby need to move towards a more simplified law book, or is that actually not really possible because of the way that the game's played?
If there's lots of big words, it's difficult for people to understand, but I do think the law book's got simpler. I think it's easier to read now than it has been in the past. In terms of laws changing, like I said before, I don't see it as the game changing. I just see it as the game evolving. The game trying to get better, trying to get faster, trying to see more of what we want to see, those end-to-end field tries, open space to run into. So I just see it as a positive movement for the laws.
Jack Willis wrote in his column in the Times on Saturday about you going into the Wasps camp in the summer and getting a grilling from him, particularly over the new law about targeting lower limbs in the ruck. And his argument, as he wrote it, was that actually he felt it'd be really difficult for a referee to understand what is allowed and what isn't allowed. He felt that law hadn't gone far enough, coming from a player who's going to miss 10, 12 months of his career having been injured in a ruck clear out like that. Can you take us into that room? Did you understand his frustration? And he said he had to apologise to you afterwards because he'd gone a little bit over the top.
So I wouldn't describe it as a grilling. He was emotional, and we had what I would call a courageous conversation. But this is the reason why it's so important we have those relationships with clubs and we spend time with them away from match day, because it gives us that chance to collaborate. So I think that was a really important conversation, not just for Jack to get some answers that maybe he needed in order to get some form of closure from something that was extremely disappointing for him. But it's great learning for me. It's great talking to coaches and getting a better understanding of what they're trying to achieve, how they see the game developing, how they see the new law changes coming into play once the games actually start. So yes, that conversation with Jack happened, but it was appropriate, and I thought it was a good thing to discuss it with him. And look, I'm an England fan. So when I saw that happen, I was disappointed. I was disappointed like every other England fan was. It just so happens that I then had that conversation with Jack, and Jack is one of rugby's good guys. He's a guy that I enjoy talking to.
Christoph, the RFU have announced in the last couple of weeks, I think they call it Pitch Up and Play, a real campaign to make sure that the lapsed players who haven't had a chance to take to a rugby field for the best part of 2 years, for obvious reasons, are attracted back to the game, back to their local clubs, to keep the community game strong. What's the situation with referees? Because you might as well, you could have 30 players out on the field playing the game, but if you haven't got the man or woman in the middle, you're going to struggle. What's the situation in terms of attracting referees back to the game? How do you keep them involved?
Look, for me, it was an opportunity after getting injured and not being able to play. You then have a choice. You either walk away from the game, which is the worst case scenario, or you stay involved. And it just so happened that refereeing, I realised, was an opportunity as well as coaching or whatever else it is you want to do. And I think that's what a lot of people don't consider, is the fact that if you don't play and you don't coach, you don't have to walk away. There's a third option, and that might be refereeing. And if you're interested in doing that, the information is there. You go to englandrugby.com/participation. There is lots of information on there about how you can get involved. There's tons of courses running up and down the country in October and November. And now should be a sort of inspiring time for all referees, not just young boys, but young girls as well. You know, Sarah Cox refereed, made her debut in the Premiership at the weekend. And as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter who you are or what you are. If you're good enough, you deserve to be there. And that is exactly what Sarah Cox showed at the weekend. She's a bloody good referee, and she should be refereeing in the Premiership. And that's exactly what she's done now, and she will continue to do for many, many years.
But just before we started this conversation, I was chatting to the others about standing on the touchline of my son's football match this weekend and comments that get made to the referees. What's it like coming through the grassroots game in rugby? Why would a referee want to put themselves in the middle and potentially face criticism from coaches and parents just for the fun of it, even if you're not being paid for it? It's not a career. What's the appeal for a new referee to go and do that?
Let's start firstly with the majority, and 99% of the time, and certainly from my experience, we aren't having negative experiences week to week. Almost all of my experiences coming through the grassroots were positive. Of course, you will get the odd person who will throw some fire, and I think that does slightly come with the territory of what we do, because you're making decisions, and some of them will go against your team, and won't go, and sometimes they will go for your team. All I would say from our perspective, especially at our level, that the RFU will deal if there is abuse. The RFU stance is there is no place for abuse. It's as simple as that. And if it's brought to their attention, they will deal with it.
Christoph, I'd just like to, on the same subject, I was with, I spoke at length to a referee who shall be nameless the other day, but he originated in the Forest of Dean. And he's absolutely brilliant, as are you and others, at conversing with players as the game's going on, even if as the ball is in play. Which is an art form, but my point is, I strongly believe that you guys who are so bloody good at it are making a rod for the backs of people who are not, because then I think it increases the level of chat and back chat and demands for explanations down through the other levels. And it's completely unwitting on your part, but I just wondered if you saw a danger that everyone now wants to, during play, in the thirds and fourths and Colts games, wants an explanation from the poor bloke who's trying to referee the game.
Yeah, and that's always going to be a danger, isn't it? Where you end up luring people in to have more conversations because you're opening up those conversations yourself. Look, if you, as far as I'm concerned, if you make good decisions, people shouldn't challenge you. So the first thing we do is be accurate. If you're right, then that instantly will stop people challenging you, or it should in the first instance. The second point around chat is we shouldn't talk for the sake of talking. When we say something in a game, it should be for a reason. It's a bit like when we blow the whistle. We're only blowing a whistle to add value to the game. Yeah. We're only talking to add value. And if I'm speaking just to be heard, or speaking for the sake of it, then when I review my game, I will say on my notes, I should not have said anything here. What's the point in speaking here? Every time I say something, it should add purpose to the game. It's a fair point, though, and it's something that is often raised.
Christoph, thank you so much for joining us. Will you come back and talk to us in a few weeks' time as your journey through these new laws goes on and you experience more and can give us some insight from on the field? It'd be great to...
Of course, I'd love to.
Magnificent. Listen, Christoph Ridley, thank you very much for joining us on The Ruck today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a million, Christoph.
Thank you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Top man Christoph Ridley, that was great. We'll have him back and we'll hold him to his promise and have him on through the season, giving you some insight into the new law trials and how they're playing out from a referee's perspective, but also his perspective on a season that has started in a way not many of us would have predicted, with Exeter Chiefs and Bristol Bears both 0-2. I think we should probably start with Bristol. I mean,
if you were those two teams, who do you think should be more worried? Because I know who I think should be more worried by some distance.
I think Bristol should be more worried, yeah. Don't you?
So Bristol have got Semi Randranja to come back, which is a clear plus. But apart from that, most of their players are available, aren't they? It's Carl Sinclair as well.
The tight heads aren't available, are they? Afoa and Sinclair.
And is the loss of John Afoa so catastrophic that changes the complete dynamic of the way the team plays? Because it just seems like their identity they're clinging to, and this is a similar thing for Exeter actually with all the players that they're missing in their front five as well, is that they're clinging to an identity but they don't seem to be getting there. And for Bristol, Slotty, do you think that missing a couple of players is so catastrophic to the way that team's held together that they've just not put in performances for 2 weeks?
I think Randranja does bring a fear factor to other teams. He is the most dynamic player in the Premiership, in my opinion. So I think that makes a change. The real other changes are loss of Ben Earl and Max Malins and Sialu Piatau, who was their defensive leader. So those are things that have changed. But the point is, with what they've got now, they've got Rendranger and some two tight heads to come back. But I don't feel it's not like the whole cavalry sort of just waiting to come back. Whereas Exeter, you feel that there's a lot of resource that's going to be available to them soon.
I think actually, lads, that Al is very very interesting to bring up John Afoa, because he may be now ancient by any standards, but I think, as Al says, he does dictate so much of their outer face and the way they play. He's probably playing better now than he ever did when he was an All Black. And I think they do miss him. I mean, when you miss the two tight heads in the modern game, even though there's so few scrums, it does have a huge effect, but rather too. I think the problem is, and I was there at the Coventry Building Society Stadium on Saturday, I think that they've tried to just tickle the way they play a bit, probably stung by what happened to them against Harlequins last year in the semi-final. And I think that they don't quite know what they're doing. They don't know whether to be Bristol, as we know and love them, or they don't know whether to rein themselves in completely, because when they were well out of the game before they started to play as recognisably Bristol. And I think that they'll be mid-table minimum, maybe higher, which is actually a failure for them. But I think the team that they wanted to represent them and to solidify them in the top division is coming to an end, and they'll need to rebuild it. But I don't think there's any panic stations. And when the two tight head props come back, I think they'll win all their home games and a few away. I think that Harlequins game derailed them mentally in a big way, Alex. And I think that's what they're struggling with. They don't quite know how to reset themselves after that.
Well, Steve, so you were at that game. I mean, age-old question. Was it that Bristol were disappointing, or conversely, how good were Wasps?
That is the age-old question. And actually, Wasps were absolutely excellent. And let's be fair, when the match was tight, Wasps were unbelievably passionate and tough and hard. When they're not actually on paper, they don't look that hard a team without Willis and Joe Launchbury, etc. But they really gave it everything, and in a way they wanted it more. So I'd say, and I may be giving Bristol a get out here, I think it was more to do with Wasps being substantially better than anyone expected. Because, I mean, Wasps have got more players out than anyone. And my goodness, they were superb. Also, they did it through flashes of genius. from Crossdale, Ali Crossdale at fullback, and the brilliance of Dan Robson, absolute brilliance of Dan Robson. So in many ways, it was old-fashioned in that individuals took a really big, had a real big say in the game. It wasn't just the eternal collective.
Last week was the first time, this is a stat from Stuart Farmer, our friend at the Premiership statistician, who said that last week was the first time Leicester had been top of the Premiership since 2011. And they're still top, having overhauled Gloucester, held off Gloucester about three different times in that game.
Yeah, and the thing about Leicester as well at the moment is, for example, they scored more driving mall tries than anyone else in the entire division last season. But this, look at this team now, and you look at the identity. I've mentioned identity a few times because I think it's a fascinating subplot for this whole season and the changes that are, who clings to what they've always been traditionally, who throws the baby out with the bathwater. But Leicester Tigers, you look at the DNA of that squad at the moment, and the young guys that are coming through are unbelievable. I mean, Tommy Rafael is fantastic, the way that he plays on the flank. But Dolly's coming through. We know that Van Poortvliet is the coming man at scrum half, and there's some scratching of heads about how he didn't make it into the England squad. But considering who he's up against in Youngs as for that starting position, there's just something it feels like they've caught something with a group of youngsters at that Leicester team, and they're playing with real confidence. And it's funny, you look at the teams that we talked about earlier who are slightly disappointing because of where they've come from and what we expect of them. How much a part is confidence playing, and how much is it just going, go out and play, lads? Because it's exciting to watch, and it's something that if you're a diehard of Leicester, you've been through some rough patches in the last couple of years, pining for the times of old, when really, actually, the grass might actually be a bit greener.
I think so. Just on the development of that new generation, one of the things that I think is interesting about this is these kids have been coming through while Exeter have been struggling. And it's much easier to bring through a new generation when there's a successful team around them to find their way into it, which is one of the reasons why I think Saracens have been able to perpetuate sort of one generation after the next, and we sort of kind of feel that Saracens have got another group coming through at the moment. So that's one thing that I think is sort of particularly impressive about Leicester is these kids have sort of probably been looking around the last couple of seasons going, Christ, this is, you know, we're all in trouble over here because the coach keeps on getting sacked at every season, the management can't work out what to do, and where are we going? But the whole thing's come together without that sort of winning structure around them.
This weekend saw the first round of the new United Rugby Championship. So you wrote about that at the weekend. And the thing that struck me from your piece, you know, was there's a new competition with fewer matches, which is probably the first time in this kind of great expansionist era of rugby that anyone's got actually less is more, quality over quantity.
It's never going to catch on, is it?
It's probably not. But what did you make of that whole vision, Roc Nation's involvement, the revolution of that competition?
Well, I think in theory the sort of brochure looks great, if you like. I'd buy a holiday to that place any day. We're yet to find out if you sort of get there and can I carry on this holiday metaphor? No,
yeah, how far
it.
Are you going to take this?
There's no electricity.
End of holiday metaphor. The results over the first weekend were, you know, a shame in that the exciting new South Africans were all apart from the Lions that beat Benetton. Leinster completely smashed the Bulls, which was the most exciting matchup of the weekend. And we know that the South African teams are weakened because the rugby calendar's so completely bloody stupid that the Springboks are off playing, so the South Africans aren't at full force. So, you know, ifs and buts and maybe. So I just hope it'll it'll change, which it has to, and it will a bit. And I hope their plans for, I was excited about their ideas to market rugby, which no one really has done the last decade, really, that we've noticed particularly. I mean, that was a great idea. Let's make it exciting for everyone. I think there's the best potential there. But if the rugby's not good, if Leinster win hands down again, then we haven't really seen any change.
Only rugby marketing could start a major new competition and very unwieldy involving South African teams for the first time on the day that South Africa play New Zealand.
For the 100th time. The famous 100th
game. Stark raving lunacy. I do think, and I watched a few of the games, or as much as I can, that there was an extra bite in the games which actually would have taken place anyway under the old systems. You know, like I watched Newport and Ospreys and Cardiff Connaught seem to have some bite in it. And I think that, you know, it had a certain freshness there. But the whole thing, it depends on whether in the long away trips people field a side. Will Johnny Sexton play when they go down to South Africa? Will the great South African players come up with the team? If they, up to our countries, and if they don't, it invalidates the competition and makes it a waste of time. And if South Africa, look, I'm sorry about player welfare, but if South Africa come up and don't bring their full sides, well, they don't deserve to go forward into the European Cup. So it is so unwieldy. You wish it the best, and there were a few promising signs, but they've got it all to do to establish the event.
That's the great selling point of this new competition, isn't it? We've been promised that it won't. Now, obviously, it's already infringing on the Rugby Championship, so it's infringing on the test calendar in the Southern Hemisphere. In the Northern Hemisphere, the great promise is that there's not going to be any overlap, so you should, in theory, have your Sextons et al. Playing for Leinster. Now, Leinster obviously are the strongest team in the competition. They're a test side, let's be honest, and they can afford to experiment against a team like the Bulls, who are the reigning Currie Cup champions. They can afford to say, by the way, we're going to let Cian Healy come off the bench at tight head for the first time in his career and see how he goes. We're going to let Porter play at loose head for the first time in years and see how he goes. But that, as Steve's right, that is what the competition needs. It needs their star turns to turn up. The other great promise that they've got is that it will be more regional. So it's interesting to hear Steve say that there seems a bit of bite in the games that already were existing in the whatever iteration we've just had, the Pro 39,000 or whatever it was. The setup, we're told, is that and in fact, Mark Palmer of the Sunday Times Scotland wrote a great piece detailing exactly how it all pans out, if you can find that somewhere. But the way it works is that there will be regional shields, which is effectively going back to the old tradition of all the sides from the same country will play each other home and away, and then they'll play everyone else once, home or away. So fewer games, more competition, we're told, and that we'll see the test stars. Steve's right. We need to see those big names. And, okay, Leinster can chuck out their third choice team. But if we see teams like Munster picking star names, and we saw RG Snyman playing for the first time since he was in a crazy fire pit accident, he needed a skin graft. He was playing at the weekend. We saw Gareth Anscombe play for the first time in 2 years, making his debut for the Ospreys. And what a time for him to come in with all the injuries at fly half for Wales as we rocket towards November. Hopefully we're seeing these names more and more, and if they do, potentially they're going to have to market that, and then the entertainment value is going to have to come from that.
What's the marketing plan, Slotty? And I mean, in terms of product on the field, the Premiership has had all of it for the last 2 weeks. But as we would often say, the marketing around it could do some work. What can they learn from what Roc Nation and the URC plan?
Well, I mean, we have to yet to see this put into action. But what Roc Nation say, Roc Nation are this entertainment agency, are a partner of the URC. And what they say is that they want to make heroes of rugby players. They want kids to know. They want to make them cool. And anyone can say that, but we know in the rugby media that rugby players are so reluctant to step forward and show their personalities. For once, I was listening to agency, what sounded like sort of agency speak, claptrap, whatever, going, yes, I completely agree with everything that you say. And it's going to require quite a big mindset change from all the clubs in the URC to go, yeah, we will put our players up, not necessarily for traditional media to do more interesting interviews, which hopefully they will do as well. But I think they're going to, it's a social media thing, and how, you know, whatever their social media presence is going to be, it's going to make them more exciting. And if they can drive that forward, then you might get the Gallagher Premiership clubs looking over their shoulder going, oh yeah, it can be done, can't it?
Coming up on The Ruck, we're going to talk about England. Since we last spoke to you, Eddie Jones has named his first squad of the season. minus a few big names, and we will get to our god or goddess of the week. As we speak to you today, the England squad are in camp in Teddington. We were told there's going to be one full-on training session, and a lot of it was admin setting their stall out for the autumn campaign to come, with games against Tonga, Australia and South Africa. That 45-man squad most notably did not feature Mako Vunipola, Billy Vunipola, George Ford or Jamie George, and there was also no place for Ben Earl or Jack Noel, two pretty established England players. And it was packed full of young, exciting players, I think 10 of whom were capped in the summer, Stephen Owen, while you guys were in South Africa, and then I think 8 more uncapped players. Steve, you weren't very impressed, I don't think, with the number of young boys being brought through.
Reading between the lines of Steve's column, I sense that as well.
Yeah, you could have made it a bit more obvious, I think, Steve, that you disapproved of Eddie's squad.
Well, the national lottery, you mean?
That was a good line. I did like that line. Just in short, what did you disapprove? What do you disagree with about his selection here for a preliminary autumn squad?
Well, based on the numbers, he's now chosen 178 players, which is totally incoherent for a start. We don't want a load of youngsters. They can prove themselves elsewhere. We want hard-nosed players to win international matches, which England have forgotten to do. We want less chat about the World Cup, which is absolutely in the far distance, and more about winning a Grand Slam to get Twickenham and the nation back with the team, because the two are separate entities at the moment. As I said in the piece, I can never remember a time where the country is less enamoured or even out of contact with the team. Just to pick 45 people, with another 8 or 7 or 8 on the naughty step, being treated like infants, sucking lollipops, is also ridiculous. Let's keep this squad as an elite, not a catch-all. Let's have some decisions made, not, I can't make up my mind, we better have all 45. And it's ridiculous. And for a one-day camp, they should never have bothered.
Steve, I disagree with quite a lot of the makeup of the squad and the way it's been done. But the thing about the kids is, we had the same conversation when Eddie picked his squad to go to Argentina in 2017. Yet from that squad, we got Tom Curry and Sam Underhill, the best flankers in the World Cup, and also Joe Kokonasinga, who was injured for the World Cup, but could have been a game breaker. Those three players, they came through on that.
So if England had not gone to Argentina that year, those players would not have come through.
Well, what I'm saying is, if Eddie hadn't chanced his arm on players that hadn't really established themselves, but he thought had potential, then they wouldn't have come through. No, I think a more.
But he had to do that because the others weren't available. There was a Lions tour.
No, he could. Argentina tour, there were. I remember sitting there and we were going, oh, he should have picked Don Armand and other established. There was a tier of players who we thought were the next in line, and he ignored them and brought through some younger kids who turned out.
And he wasted a generation.
Well, you could say that, but I wouldn't say that Tom Curry and Sam Underhill would be classified as a waste.
This thing about, you see that the England under 20 team, all these players came through with the England under 20s. All these players came through on this tour or that tour. Of course they did, because they were the best players, and they were always going to come through. Someone going on a jaunt to Argentina to play a weak Pumas, that doesn't produce international rugby players. It's just rugby players are produced in the Premiership.
It did, and Joe Kokonasinga wasn't the next best player because he hadn't actually played a single Premiership game in on that tour. So it was.
And where is he now?
But he's still potentially a great player, but he's been so injured the last 2 years that he hasn't been able to show it.
Well, every time I've seen him, he hasn't anything remotely like a great player, Slotty. Well,
but Steve, do you think that the point you were making in that piece and you're sort of hinting at here subtly is is that these players who didn't make it, Billy Vunipola, should be there because he's the best in his position? But we've had so many discussions over the last couple of years, probably 4 years, about Billy. He's not been at his best, and England have waited and waited and waited, and they They played him the whole way through a World Cup in the hope that we would see that Billy Vunipola, who was picked for the Lions tour in 2017, when I think he was absolutely at his peak, and it never happened. And are you saying that the team that has lost the belief and faith of the fans should just be stuck with because they're the most senior, experienced players?
Well, you either leave them all out on the naughty step, including Owen Farrell, who's actually been equally, and if not more, ineffective than Billy. But just to kick three people out is just utter childishness, and say, oh, well, they might be back if they improve. That's not how to treat international rugby players. And people like Billy and Mako Vunipola, first of all, they always play better when they're both in the same team, which is inconvenient for England. But just to pick so many people to try and make an example of them, especially George Ford, who's on magnificent form, is just pathetic. It's just schoolboy, school playground childishness.
So, I mean, that's a fascinating call, that one on George Ford, because he's playing brilliantly. But they do have Marcus Smith, who they want to play as well. And I sense that the idea of having Ford and Farrell both there in an England squad would actually make it harder for Marcus Smith to be given his head, to take a leadership role, to actually...
Alex, it should be hard for Marcus Smith to be given his head. He's so far, he's played off the front foot in some games where it was necessary. He's not remotely shown that he's an international rugby player yet. International rugby player is different. He should be made to fight like mad for his place.
Do you not think he's doing that through his performances? My point back to you is that once he's in the camp, if you want to get the best out of a player who could potentially be the quarterback of this team, to lead the team, be a senior player in the leadership group, and on and off the field, that to inhibit him by making one of three would actually make you'd get less benefit of having him in the camp.
Well, if there's three people, then everyone's inhibited. It is time he made up his mind about the fly half, okay? Whether it's Smith or whatever, it's the time he made up his mind, not keep on shuffling the pack.
But this conversation's sounding a bit as if Alex and I are defending Eddie's great squad, and we're on opposing sides to Steve on this. There's tons about the squad and Eddie's selection that is baffling. So the thing that gets me is that he has started to invest in new players, but then he withdraws the investment, like Ben Earl, for instance. You know, he invested a year and a half's worth in Ben Earl, and I thought that he was getting some return on it. So why stop there? He invested a year in Ollie Thorley as the great new young sort of bustling winger, but Ollie Thorley's not worth investing anymore, and Lewis Lyon is the next of that calibre. So I'm all for Eddie spotting bright talent and then backing it, but I mean, it's his scrum half policy in particular shows that he might see something he likes, but he can't stick with it. And that's where I think the danger is.
It goes back to the whole run of people. Tamana Harrison, Paul Hill, all the people who were meant to come in and be brilliant and then were discarded and actually probably had their confidence wrecked. And look, I'm sorry. I keep on looking at people saying this is good old Eddie. And I think, hang on, where did they finish in the last Six Nations? Humiliatingly, and I'm afraid that this is the national rugby team, and just like a political journalist with the government, I'm going to harry him till they start getting results remotely as good as the standard of what England rugby should be.
Steve, you've talked so long on England that you've managed to talk us out of our segment on the North London Derby. So that filibustering effort was very successful on your part.
I knew that would work.
right, let's wrap up. God or goddess of the week. I know everyone thinks about this in advance, so I'm sure it's on the tip of your tongues, Slotty.
I'm so glad you came to me first. This is the most obvious choice of the week, and someone had to say it. So I would be delighted to anoint my... Do we anoint them? Appoint them? Recommend them?
Exalt.
My goddess of the week is Sarah Cox, who was the first female referee in a Premiership game ever, and that is just a wonderful statement for the game, and praise be, may there be many more like that. What a path find as she is.
You'll do well to beat that one, I think.
Yeah, I mean, how am I supposed to disagree with that? He's bang on. That's exactly who I was going to say. But you know, I'll cover my countrymen. Darcy Graham's double at the weekend for Edinburgh in a cracking game against Scarlets. I think he deserves some praise, but obviously Slotty's right.
Can I just say something else about that, about her refereeing of that game? It's one of the great things about it is there was so little coverage afterwards. I mean, there was a lot of people, a lot of little pictures in the paper going, oh, look, that's the first time a woman has refereed a Premiership game. But there was so little debate about her decisions or this or that, which normally happens. And when that's the case, that is a success. It's a statement of success.
Steve?
The two good ones there. Darcy Graham's try, I thought, was absolutely sensational, Al. And obviously, Sarah Cox, Slotty, can't argue with that. I am going to have one of my own, though, and it's Dan Robson. Dan Robson is meant to be at the veteran stage now, but the way he dominated Andy Ure and Harry Randall on Saturday at the CBC Stadium was sensational. And, you know, the Ewan and Randall are tremendous players, but he was, Robson was at them all the time and just bossed the game, absolutely regal, and should have won many more caps. So we've got three contenders there. It's all down to you, Arthur.
Good effort, guys, there on promoting Dan Robson and Darcy Graham, but Slotty's right. There is only one winner of God or Goddess of the Week, and it is the Goddess of the Week, Sarah Cox. So congratulations to her being anointed, exalted, however, whatever we do with it.
We were at one point going to have we were going to make a Goddess of the Week mug or T-shirt or something to send to them. So
should do. We definitely need merch. We need some Ruck merch. We should all have our own T-shirts.
That's why they go into the game, isn't it? So they could become a God or Goddess.
Yeah, so Christoph Ridley's like halfway, he's appeared on the Ruck, which is he could get a T-shirt.
Or you could save all the money and have an open-top bus parade at the end of the season.
What, with all the gods,
with
and
all the gods and goddesses on it.
I like
that.
Big party.
But just on Dan Robson, Jones, I'm glad you mentioned him. I think that he might be the great international that we know absolutely nothing about. I think his international career is going to fizzle out because Eddie won't back him, and we will never know how good he could have been, because that's a player that needs support, confidence, regular picking, just as he has with Wasps, and look how he flourishes, and it's not going to happen for him, and it's such a shame.
Well, that was another episode of The Ruck where, sadly, we withheld too many opinions, weren't argumentative enough, so we'll try and up our game for next week. Thank you all for joining us. Please subscribe or follow from wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll be back in a week's time, back in the studio. Hopefully Steve will have found some petrol by then, and we'll be reunited.